This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello and welcome to the Urban Political, to our episode after long summer break. We are today talking about urban sovereignty, radical cities in Latin America and elsewhere with Gianpaolo Baiocchi. Introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you. My name is Gianpaolo Baiocchi. I am a Brazilian-born but U.S.-based urban scholar. I teach at New York University. I direct something here called the Urban Democracy Lab, which tries to do much as your podcast to bridge the activist and scholarly divide around urban issues. And I've been interested in been working on issues of urban democracy, primarily about Brazil and Latin America for some time. And in recent years, in the most recent past, I've actually been working with some US-based organizations like Right to the City and Housing Justice for All around contemporary urban issues in the US, and trying to figure out how to leverage some of this experience as a leverage it as a way to open up spaces for meaningful action on this side of things in the US.
That's great, Gianpaolo. So we, that means my colleague, Ross Beveridge, who's sitting right next to me, and I are very pleased that you took the time to talk to us today. We had already planned to have you on board on the episode discussing the more recent book collecting Murray Bookchin's works. So we're happy to have you today in a solo conversation. And to get us started, I'd like to have you talk about one of your main interests, urban politics in Latin American cities, particularly the progressive or radical governments of the movements in the 1990s and 2000s. So, Gianpaolo, could you provide us with an overview of what you have termed radical cities in Latin America, moving from the past to the present?
Thank you, Marcus. And before I start, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for having me on your podcast. And I wanted to congratulate you. I'm actually a little bit intimidated by the range of very eloquent and good guests and good conversations you have had before me. Your podcast is really terrific. I love the ambition of connecting the scholarly and activist. I love your global scope. I love your good humor. It really is a really excellent podcast, and I really appreciate being on it with you all today. We'll put up a link on the episode website for a recent issue of a journal called the NACL Report on the Americas, where we decided to take stock of where radical cities were with Latin America today. And as you were saying, Marcus, the radical I come at it from a sort of curious point of view, which is I was very heavily involved in the radical cities discussion in Latin America, which flourished in the 90s and through the early 2000s. And it was pretty insular in the sense that, you know, people looked back at some experiments and looked to Eastern Europe in some way. But it sort of developed pretty autonomously from this municipalist discussion that we have today. So it struck me 2-3 years ago, like, wow, the municipalist discussion, it has this very strong European accent to some extent. Bookchin, of course, is, Vermont, was a Vermont-based thinker. It's a little bit about the United States, but it's mostly European. And so in this issue, we were trying to figure out how the Latin America story relates and doesn't relate to this municipalist, important municipalist discussion. So a first thing, you know, is we have to sort of place the Latin America version in some context. And I tend to think, if you don't mind just me taking 2 minutes to talk about this, I tend to think of Latin America radical city or radical cities having sort of three generations to them. So there's one kind of early pioneer cities, and this is, you know, might be Porto Alegre in Brazil, or might be one of the early cities, via El Salvador and Peru in the 80s. Anyways, as these countries were almost all of them coming out of military dictatorships, and this was, of course, during a period of structural adjustment, and people were moving to cities in very large numbers, what was happening was the city itself and urban and imagining the urban in a different way was a kind of like object for activists. And so because too the left had been decimated by these military regimes, a lot of these activists were sort of disconnected, or their connection to the older leftist thinking, which did not necessarily see the city as an important battleground, that was interrupted. And so they were kind of inventing anew what a radical city might look like. They were very intent on recapturing institutions, you know, whether it was transportation or housing or any of the number of issues that was super salient as these cities were experiencing austerity and large numbers of migrants. So there were the early cities, and they were, many of them were successful. So the sort of autonomous leftists might win city government. In many places, they invented or discovered or rediscovered systems of popular assemblies. They had this idea of opening up parts of municipal machinery to these assemblies or to direct citizen input. They experimented a long time. And sort of this first generation transforms as the national left of center parties begin to have success. So the next thing that happens is that many of these municipal radicals become part of national left of center parties or left of center regimes. You know, everybody knows about the Pink Tide, which was this moment, the so-called Pink Tide in Latin America, when left of center parties were essentially hegemonic in the region. So from Uruguay all the way, you know, Mexico did not have a left of center government, but left of center forces were present. And so during the Pink Tide, a lot of these cities became kind of marquee cities, sort of like demonstrations of what these progressive left politics could look like at the municipal level. So during this next period, a lot of these experiences multiply. There's a tremendous amount of learning from city to city. There are many, many, many networks promoting local democracy. European funding comes in, and the UN comes in and begins to exchange ideas between regions. And there's a tremendous amount of ferment in a context that seemed hopeful at the national level. So, you know, if you were to visit any one of these cities, you know, if you would happen to go to São Paulo during one of the Workers' Party administrations, or you're going to Montevideo, you know, you would find a very hopeful sense of what radical municipal politics could look like. And it was a fairly, in contrast to Puchkin, for example, it was a fairly straightforward story that people used to understand, which is look, municipal politics provide a space for a kind of direct democracy via assemblies, citizen meetings. People are able to turn over a lot of decision-making to the citizen mandate, and this activates a sort of popular politics that then scales up and finds, you know, expression in the national mandate. You know, so it was not uncommon, again, to return to the city of Porto Alegre, which was perhaps the Brazilian marquee case. And I would attend meetings, and, you know, there were meetings on municipal investments and some of one of the poorer regions of the city. People were making demands, and the mayor would show up and he would say, those are terrific. We can't meet them. We need to make sure we win the next national election and we put people in Congress so that our municipal politics, our radical municipal politics, can be supported. So it was kind of like a vision of autonomous radical democracy that somehow could scaffold up and be supported by a friendly national government. And this was true in many, many cases. Another important, more radical example is El Alto in Bolivia. You know, it was more autonomous than some of the other cases. You know, the worker cooperatives and this idea of having something outside the state was very, very important. But even there was a sense that, look, the national government sort of has our back, and this is part of building up. There was a sense of always scaffolding and growing. And then when we did this issue, of course, the pink tide, you know, now we talk about the great U-turn in Latin America. Many, many countries, right-wing governments have come in very violently. Brazil is essentially, you know, has as president a fascist wannabe who is, and, you know, we're having very strong anti-left sentiment. A lot of things are being rolled back. There's no support for many of the initiatives that emerge at the local level. And so now we have this newest generation of sort of municipalist or radical activism that is sort of like the Butchkin version, which is, it's about building local politics. It's about creating those radical spaces where new demands and new civic power and popular power can emerge, but with a great deal of skepticism towards, or more skepticism towards, a national government or a national political party that is going to be able to come in and rescue and help. And the last thing I'll say is that, to give you, if in 2005, if you randomly showed up at a large Latin American municipal center, it was probably leftist and it was probably hopeful. Half of the essays that we received on radical cities in Latin America were about radically conservative cities, radical pro-market reforms, which gives you a sense of just how far the pendulum has shifted. So that is sort of, you know, now we're trying to make sense of what worked and what didn't, and what are some of the lessons and so on. But as we put it in, you know, in dialogue with this global municipalist discussion, I always like to have a sort of historical interlude. Of course, the discourse and the history and the trajectory is different, but the world around these cities and the national context around these cities has shifted very dramatically over the span of 20 years.
Thanks for that overview, Jean-Paul. We might come back to this, the kind of pessimism and this concern around radical conservative cities, as I think you called them. But you touched on it already just before, so I wondered if we could go a little bit deeper into it. Thinking about the new municipalism as a political project, as a kind of intellectual project as well, how would you relate Latin American experiences to what's going on now, not only in Europe, but elsewhere, particularly thinking perhaps in terms of some of the, and you touched on some of the intellectual similarities, dissimilarities, some of the political similarities and dissimilarities. The interesting thing about this, perhaps this move to, from having kind of a politics aimed at all scale to the urban level, at the city level, basically the city level, it's about aiming to garner support at the national level, or to get success at the national level, to this kind of more Butchin type approach where it's about creating radical spaces and the possibilities which come from those spaces in themselves. And I'm rambling a bit now, so I'll try to make a question out of that. So some of the similarities, dissimilarities, and perhaps some of the lessons which you think can be taken from the Latin American experiences.
Yeah, so I think that's right. That's right. I tend to see the similarities and the dissimilarities in the way you've framed it, Ross. So I think, you know, the specter of the national has always loomed larger for the Latin American municipal, if we call it Latin American municipalism or Latin American radical cities. You know, I was just reading, there's a nice essay in the NACLA report by Angus McNally about El Alto, which in Bolivia, you know, was one of the most interesting examples of a kind of radical municipal politics that was very centered on radical spaces that were jealously, you know, people guarded their autonomy from the state very, very seriously. You know, the kind of local radical politics are really important. And El Alto was doing stuff, but people had an eye on La Paz, the capital city, at the same time. So I think one difference is this sort of like national horizon always being there, at least through to recent times. I think it's for a couple of reasons. So one, I think the political culture that this emerges from in Latin America is more statist. Anyway, the left has always been more statist. I think too that there is some there's some sense that the national questions were too important for people's survival, in a way that, you know, you could imagine people more easily turning their backs on national questions, or if not turning their backs, sort of bracketing them. You know, in Bolivia, one of the things that happened under the National MAS was a new constitution that recognized indigenous rights and radically transformed education. Or in the case of Brazil, you know, questions of funding and literacy and basic healthcare, still, you know, there's little, it was hard for them to imagine building that sort of radical local power without having some thought to that, just on the basis of questions of day-to-day survival. So I think that's one difference. I think relatedly, the question of the political party somehow has tended to be more important in Latin America. And in here, you know, the Latin American experiences are closer to the Spanish municipalist experiences than some of the other European ones, in that people spent a lot of time trying to imagine and reimagine what a political party would look like. In my book on sovereignty, We the Sovereign, I talk a little bit about this formulation people had, which was inside, alongside, or outside of institutions like political parties and the state. And they always had this idea that they would participate in a political party, but that there was an important counterweight to be had outside. They would participate in reforming the municipal state, to transform the way that schools and transportation budgets were allocated. But their vision was this sort of inside reform could only really be radical if there was a kind of counterweight, if there was something on the outside as well, you know. And this is resonant with the Butchkin kinds of ideas, which was these autonomous spaces for radical imaginings that weren't captured by the bureaucratic mandate. And to me, you know, I sort of take two contradictory lessons from it. One is that engaging these institutions was meaningful and is meaningful, and we just have to think of how to do it in a way that doesn't capture the radical imagination. But the other lesson was that in many Latin American cases, energies got absorbed. And, you know, look, having meetings outside of institutions to discuss long-term political subjectivities and produced fewer results than going to a meeting deciding where the budget was going to be spent. And so in some way, energies wound up being captured by institutions, and the outside spaces that was supposed to be a counterweight, that people, you know, in their writing and in their interviews and in their day-to-day talk worried about a lot, those outside spaces wound up being sucked up by the institutional struggle. To return to the case of Brazil is a remarkable story of tremendous policy success and tremendous redistribution that wasn't accompanied by this autonomous organizing in these political spaces, so that a fascist or neo-fascist political project could just come and weirdly occupy it because all the activists and all the energies were focused on bureaucratic matters. So I guess it's these two lessons. You know, all the time when I talk to activists or I talk to, you know, people thinking about bridging activists and scholarly, or, you know, the discussions here in the US about political parties, I always encourage people to not turn away from that. But, you know, a key lesson is trying to figure out some way to do it that doesn't suck up all the energy and doesn't, you know, wind up colonizing those radical spaces.
One thing that I might be wrong, but one thing I think both Latin American experiences and the more recent new municipalist projects have in common is that they're both kind of democratic projects or radical democratic projects. What do you think are the positive aspects of that, and perhaps the limitations of this as democracy as a political imaginary?
Yeah, no, thank you for saying that. Sorry, we wind up in these days always having instrumental conversations about things. Of course, the central similarity of the new municipalism with the European municipalism and these early Latin American examples and contemporary Latin American examples is that they have this, at the heart, they are radically democratic projects. In the Latin American case, that meant it was a project of democratizing knowledge, democratizing expertise, constantly questioning itself about the democraticness of its representation. I did a little bit of writing about with my Spanish colleague Ernesto Ganusa about some of a little bit about the Indignados in Spain, and many of the discussions people were having, which is how do we democratize our sense of who we are and how are we building that and constantly working on that is absolutely a similarity. So in the Latin American case, to be specific, it was always an effort to increase the reach of democratic decision making. So, you know, what procedures and processes can we democratize? But it was also an effort to democratize the public, have more and more different kinds of people. So, you know, a constant worry in many of these Latin American cases was, you know, making sure or working at making sure that it's not only university professors and university students and radical intellectuals who are the spokespeople. It was thinking about gender and a little bit lesser extent back then anyway, questions of sexuality. It was about democratizing the public in terms of race and bringing in those questions. So the radical democraticness is absolutely central. And, you know, a shared concern with the current municipalists or a shared insight is that that sort of project is more possible at the local level. And it's more possible when the institutions are visible and the people are knowable and, you know, at that sort of scale. And, you know, in the case of Latin America now, there is an interesting sort of rethinking and questioning of that in a couple of ways. One of the ways people are questioning is, was it really, you know, in Brazil, they have this phrase, it's sort of the gamble on institutions. And the idea that the radical democratic project, in the case of Brazil, was to do that and build this ever more radical sense of the people and the public while investing in democratic institutions. So make them elections fairer, make parties better, and a kind of thinking that why was all this investment in institutions and in democratic procedures when the far right and the right was not interested in playing along those lines? You know, the democratic institutions that were built in Brazil turned out to be very thin defenses against, you know, WhatsApp and international consultants and legal challenges. You know, they didn't hold very long when the national democracy was challenged. And then I think there is another interesting line of thinking about the limits of the radical democratic project. You know, not only are they worried about, was it too much focus on process and formal institutions, but this question of representation and scaling up maybe wasn't as easy as people thought. Somehow moving from the radical representation of the local assembly and the neighborhood council to all the way through a representative process, either for a national party or the national parliament, turned out to be more difficult to do. You know, the Workers' Party in Brazil had a number of, you know, this is not a conspiracy theory, this is, you know, self-inflicted wounds with some corrupt politicians who had been from movements, and somehow there wasn't a way for that kind of local democracy to exert power over, you know, these kinds of like national actors. In a way, they were able to sort of escape the reach of that local radical democracy. Yeah, so for sure, radical democracy is at its center. And I think there's interesting thinking now about, you know, what might that look like moving forward, or what can a radical democratic vision do before this new, very difficult context that many of these people are facing?
I'd like to ask you about the suburbanization and this kind of process of extended urbanization that has also affected Latin America tremendously over the past few decades, and how what these kind of spatial processes have meant for radical transformative urban politics. And I mean, I guess this has posed also significant challenges in view of generating local autonomy and or confederations of localist projects. I wonder if you can speak to that significance of these suburban developments.
No, I think the suburban developments are absolutely part of the puzzle, and to some extent, the inability to face them or understand them in time has to do with this conservative backlash. So, you know, as the Latin American suburbanization has been taking place at a very, very fast pace, you know, colleagues who do satellite, they have to use satellite images because the growth in the suburban areas of large cities is so fast, you know, that the censuses can't capture it. You know, people talk about wild growth and these suburban frontiers where you have these tremendous jurisdictional issues. So most, for example, to take a city like São Paulo, the growth in these suburban areas is orders of magnitude faster than happens in the center city or more traditional urban areas. And these, and the way that the legal framework works in Brazil, and this is somewhat similar in other Latin American countries, is that there's a fair amount of autonomy for these suburban, for these municipalities. So, you know, the metro region of São Paulo, I believe, has 27 municipalities, only one of which is São Paulo City. And the remaining 26 are growing very, very fast. The way that the resources are distributed means that the tax base and the resource base for these suburban areas is just a tiny, tiny fraction. In other words, the federalist arrangement tends to favor center cities and capital cities and cities where financial services, for example, take place. So what you have is very, very large and growing poor populations far from city centers, often working in city centers, but living lives, you know, sometimes these commuter lives are, you know, people have average commutes sometimes 2, 3, 4 hours to get to these outside suburban areas with extremely underfunded municipalities. So the difficulties of organizing in those has been a tremendous challenge. So outside of São Paulo, there's a city called Guarulhos, which is where the airport is. Guarulhos has traditionally had a very leftist radical administration and has had very radical urban movement. But for them to organize and win victories at the local level in Guarulhos, they have very little, it has very little practical consequence. In other words, you know, because it's an underfunded city that's depending on transfers, the traditional formula that people had, you know, the leftist formula, which was to win the local city government based in these movements, turn over decisions to these movements that would then sort of activate local democracy because people are seeing real results, has been difficult. People's lives in these suburban areas are often more difficult. you know, the way that a lot of services in Brazil were organized, from health to education to social services, they're provided for at the municipal level. So all of those elements are more difficult. Brazil doesn't have anything resembling real regional planning. So to get from one of those outside areas to center city often involves, you know, many, many transfers with a completely irrational transportation system. And the organizing project, the political organizing project of building up these spaces, you know, even bracketing the question of whether they can access municipal power or not, is more difficult. And to sort of add insult to injury, in some of these suburban metro areas, the very conservative churches have made tremendous inroads in organizing people's consciousnesses at a time where leftists, if not abandoned, have given up to some extent. So when Bolsonaro won, you know, and it was a little bit of a shock to people in Brazil, he had very, very strong voting from some of these areas. The issue of violence tends to be actually very bad in some of these suburban metro areas. The wealthy people who live in suburbs, because of these lax regulations, are able to live almost entirely separate lives in these gated communities. So, you know, in some of these suburban areas, you know, you might drive past, you'll see an airport, you see an exclusive shopping mall, you see two or three gated communities, and you see vast expanses of sort of informal or semi-formal housing. In the political project of organizing something like a municipalist alliance or a confederation or assemblies is very, very difficult. Oh, and of course, this is maybe an obvious point to listeners of this podcast and to you, but just the spatial layout of some of these suburban areas also militates against, you know, distances are vast. There, you know, there's not a town square where people can meet. There are no obvious places for meeting. Yeah, so absolutely the suburbanization is part of the story. And I think it poses a significant challenge. I believe that the urban growth nationally, to use the example of Brazil again, is much higher in suburban areas than in city centers at the moment.
That's a fascinating insight and speaks to lots of topics we discussed with Roger Kyle on an earlier podcast in his book, Suburban Planet. Changing tack slightly, Gianpaolo, some of your more recent work has been more directly about democracy, more theoretical, drawing on the Latin American experiences. Your last book, We the Sovereign, develops this notion of popular sovereignty, and you've also written about popular democracy. Could you outline your understandings of these concepts and how they relate to the urban or these kind of radical city experiences?
Well, thank you for asking. So We the Sovereign, so Popular Democracy was a book with a Spanish colleague, Ernesto Ganusa, who I've mentioned. And we tried to take stock of traveling toolkits about participation and, you know, in particular, participatory budgeting, traveling the world as a sort of good governance practice. And what, in this era where everyone is for participation, but few people will let you have substantive democracy, what spaces does something like participatory budgeting, in fact, open? And in that book, we came to a conclusion that pleased absolutely no one, which is participatory budgeting works when it breaks down, that is, when people get mad at it for not providing the substantive democracy. And We the Sovereign was, I wrote that shortly after Trump was elected in the United States. And I wanted to sort of rescue this Latin American theory of popular sovereignty, which to my mind had been slightly misunderstood. As you know, the country was taking, you know, as the continent was taking this U-turn, you know, there was a lot of social democratic celebration of the pink tide. And then when it started to unravel, there was a lot of leftist condemnation for not being radical enough. And I wanted to rescue this theory of popular sovereignty and try to remind people of the radical potential that it had and the radical political project that it actually was. So We the Sovereign, so the argument of the book is also its title. So popular sovereignty for many of these theorists, and as I sort of distilled in the book, is a contradictory political project. So is if you imagine the most radical we, the most horizontal, internally democratic, porous, and expansive notion of a people, on one hand, combined with the most absolute sense of self-determination possible. So ultimate sovereignty for an ultimately democratic political subject, an ultimate democratic plural and horizontal political subject. So this vision, I argue in the book, is actually unites both the MAS in Bolivia, the Zapatistas, and Workers' Party in Brazil, and many, many others. And this was kind of like an orienting political project. In other words, it wasn't so much a blueprint or stages, but a kind of like, you know, there's the phrase, we'll make the road by walking, sort of telling you which way to walk. And I wanted to rescue that, you know, as the recriminations of these leftist governments and the recriminations about these local municipal experiments for not being radical enough, I wanted to rescue it to say, look, might have been that they wound up not being as radical as intended, but they did not intend to be neoliberal or social democratic or whatever the charge, or governance oriented reformist socialism, whatever the charges actually are. I wanted to, there was a plan. There was an idea that this kind of strong version of a state held in check by the strong plural subject was an imagining of how to bring about another society. And although I don't say this much in the book, I've been criticized for having an urban bias in the book. Most of this theory was hatched up in the context of these urban experiments. I wanted this to be a reminder of the radical theory that I understood to be at the center of this project in Latin America in the 90s through the early 2000s. And I think it's one that's worth people engaging with. I always tell young activists in Europe, but also in the United States, and now increasingly I go to Brazil, and there's a generational distance between current activists and this earlier stuff. This is all part of our legacy. Whoever is trying to be a partisan of a better future and better cities and radical democracies now has this as part of their legacy. And I think it's a set of ideas worth at least engaging with. And I wanted to also use the word sovereignty because autonomists and anarchists have such an allergy to it. And I wanted it to be a little provocative. and to remind people that the vision of sovereignty, of local sovereignty, of radical democratic sovereignty people had was different, was not necessarily the kind of sovereignty that, you know, people argue against on the left today.
So just that was a great overview of the book. Just thinking of that in relation to, I think, going back and thinking in relation to the new municipalism, what's happening now, and this notion of popular sovereignty. Can you see that informing the new municipalism in direct, indirect ways? I mean, certainly there might be something around the idea of the state as a kind of political, as a popular project, but do you see that legacy informing what's happening in Europe and elsewhere, in Latin America and in the States and in other places?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one of the things that I did not do in the book, because I think it's too wordy and there's too much said about it already, you know, this has some relation to a kind of left populist project and this idea of popular sovereignty, for example, in Spain, and it exists within Podemos in some ways. And I know folks from Barcelona and Comú, when they think of what their relationship to the state is and ought to be, and what should the state be, and replacing the state with, or thinking of the state as a porous target of popular power with the aim to transform it, I think it definitely, in that context, it definitely dialogues with it. I think in the United States, it's kind of interesting because there's such a strong hatred of the state at the moment among people, you know, among activists sometimes, that this is a harder sell. But I feel like it's absolutely important. You know, for example, I don't remember this being talked about in one of your shows, but people maybe know that the Democratic Socialists of America, for example, has been becoming increasingly influential. And the City Council of Chicago, if I'm not mistaken, is 10% DSA at the moment, which sounds like science fiction. And it's not unthinkable that it could be 25% or 30%, and they'll be in a position to actually seriously reform or seriously address some local institution in Chicago. And for that, I think thinking back about this radical democratic vision of state as transformable and porous to popular power in a democratic way would be important. You know, I think sometimes on the other side of the left, there's a sense that, look, really good policies will just carry the day. And I think one of the lessons from, you know, one of the insights from this sort of popular sovereignty vision is that a policy is never complete, and a good idea and a good policy won't carry the day, but it's part of a process that needs to be continually fought over and can be a front to build popular power. Yeah, so I absolutely think it can relate. I'm less fluent in the discussions and in the current understanding people have about the municipal socialism in Britain. I know you had Hillary Wainwright on recently. But I feel like even there, there is an effort to sort of put this in dialogue.
So let's have a little reflection on this relationship between activist practice and academic scholarship. And so far we've focused on your work as an academic scholar, in which you have highlighted also the lessons that you draw from this these historic experiences that practitioners have made. So could you tell us a little bit in terms of how you relate your insights back to political practice, and maybe speaking about the Urban Democracy Lab that you have also co-founded?
Thank you for that. You know, I think of myself as being part of this big conversation that you are all having in the podcast and elsewhere. I think I'm a fellow traveler with you in trying to figure out, you know, what is the way to do this and be part of this relationship. You know, at the very least, how can we be useful? But at the most, maybe is there a way that we can also transform our practice as scholars? You know, I describe myself as an activist scholar, but I try not to forget the privilege that I have, that you have, which is, you know, our jobs allow us the opportunity to be exposed to many things and learn from many people. And well, before the pandemic, I guess we used to travel. We have access to a lot of information and insights. And I think one of the things I've tried to do with my scholarly work is translate and traffic and some of these insights, and try to be deliberate about how I do that. The Urban Democracy Lab sort of took its inspiration from some things I know in Latin America, but also in Spain. I think in Spain they have these fábricas de sueños, with the factories of dreams. The idea of these spaces of dialogue and thinking out loud. And so the idea of the Urban Democracy Lab started in 2014 was really to be very explicit and intentional about creating a space for dialogue across practitioners, students, activists, scholars. You know, we, having this experience in radical democracy, of course, we try to be deliberate and thoughtful about the quality of the events and public events that we do. We try to be very thoughtful about expertise and what kinds of expertise. You know, one thing I don't want to reproduce is that I, as a scholar or a person with an academic job, get to theorize. And that other people get to do things and I get to write about it. I really try to instill and have a egalitarian ethic. We've worked with a number of different organizations. You know, we try to have these partnerships. I write to the city in the United States is one. We also recently been working with an organization here in New York called Align. One of our students worked on a report they have done about a socially just, sort of this beyond recovery post-pandemic, what might it look like? One of the projects I have been doing with some colleagues is trying to think of how some of these demands that are emerging from movements now such as, you know, defund the police or cancel rent. What might that look like as policy? In other words, is there a way for us to use our expertise or our language or research? What would a cancel rent policy look like? How much would it cost? You know, trying to give some of that scaffolding. I'll put an essay, I'll put a link up that you can share with the episode. I have some structured reflections on that. And I can also share a couple of these reports if you'd like to see. We did one on canceling rent. We're doing one now around private equity in real estate. One of the things that many people are predicting is that there will be a lot of residential properties, a lot of rentals are going to be in financial trouble, and they'll be purchased by private equity firms, which have set aside hundreds of billions of dollars just for this purpose. And this is going to be, you know, just an absolutely terrible outcome from the point of view of the right to the city. Yeah, so those are some of the things we've been working on. A colleague and I, Jay Carlson, we have been actually working on a proposal for a social housing investment authority or a social housing development corporation, which would be the idea that this federal authority would buy up these troubled buildings before private equity has a chance to get their hands in them, and then finance their sale to cooperatives of tenants. So, you know, find a way to use this crisis to increase the social housing sector in the United States. I think that's some of the things we've been doing with the Urban Democracy Lab. We're very concerned, of course, with what will happen, you know, next week, or by the time what will happen with the U.S. election and its aftermath. So we've been trying to give voice to organizers and activists who are preparing for the various scenarios that might happen.
Thank you very much, John Paolo.
Thanks to you for listening. For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.